Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings. Jordan Marty is off today. Preseason for the Philadelphia Eagles wraps up tonight at the Meadowlands against the Jets, and it's expected this final game before the regular season will be challenging for the Birds. For many Eagles fans, even as there is excitement and hope for 2017, things are probably feeling a bit unsettled about now. Matt McGloin has been seeing a lot of play in preseason as the third quarterback, but when the cuts are made on Saturday and the roster is in place, it seems likely McGloin will not be on the list. The other backup, Nick Foles, has been nursing a sore elbow, so it's essential that lead quarterback Carson Wentz stays healthy. Not the best of positions to be in just ahead of the regular season. Also, longtime long snapper John Dornbus has just been traded, and who will end up at wide receiver and running back? We'll be talking about all that and much more. But first, 32 years ago, Rolly Massimino's Villanova Wildcats stunned the sports world with an upset win over Georgetown for the NCAA championship.
One, they must get the ball inbounds within 5 seconds. That means it must touch a player from either team within 5 seconds. I think they've got to throw the ball up at least towards the half-court area. They cannot afford to throw that ball in under their own basket, because with 2 seconds to go, Georgetown can get a piece of it and put it back up. Let's see if Rolly Massimino tries to get the ball up court. And in a jump ball situation, the ball would go to Villanova.
That's it. Villanova has got it.
Just a little flashback to the final seconds of that huge game. Well, Coach Massimino died yesterday at the age of 82. He had been suffering from lung cancer. And joining us in studio, Ray Didinger, football analyst for CSN Philly. Welcome back, Ray.
Good to be here.
And Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
Okay. So, let's talk about Rolly first. What do you remember of that moment first to you, Ray?
Well, I was talking to someone about it yesterday, and in the context of great Philadelphia sports moments, I think it's the greatest upset that any Philadelphia team has ever accomplished. You know, the Flyers' first cup win over Boston was a huge upset. They've seen some upsets. But I don't think there's ever been one quite like Villanova beating Georgetown, because no one gave them a chance. No one gave them a chance. I mean, they were the eighth seed going in. Georgetown was undefeated and considered unbeatable. And Villanova went out and played the perfect game. I mean, it was you go back through that game and they played an absolutely perfect game. And that's what was required to beat that Georgetown team. You had to play perfect, and they did that night. And that will... You know, that will always be, Villanova has won it since, and they won it in dramatic fashion.
Sure.
And it's a game that everybody will celebrate and remember for a long time. But nothing quite like the win down in Lexington, because it was so unexpected.
Yeah. I was just starting out in this business back then, and I just remember the city being absolutely electrified. Mike Sielski, what do you know of Rolly Massimino?
Well, it's interesting. I wasn't 10 years old yet when Villanova won that national championship. Sorry to make you guys feel bad.
But that's quite all right, Mike.
I will say this, what always struck me about Rolly, and I was a college basketball fan and a Big Five fan as a kid and have covered it in the years since, what always struck me, and I think Ray could probably speak to this as well, is how fast, from the moment Villanova won that championship and was atop the college basketball world, how fast it took for Rolly to become a controversial, even more of a controversial figure than he already had been. Because Villanova now had a national championship under its belt, some would argue, I think, that it came with a bit of haughtiness afterwards. And of course, eventually Villanova and Rolly got to the point where they decided they didn't want to participate in the round robin of the Big Five and the City Series anymore, and they took a lot of blame for the destruction of the Big Five. And that's part of Rolly's story too. As great a coach as he was, and as loyal to his players as he was, and as loyal as they were to him, that's the other part of this, is kind of the aftermath of that championship.
Right.
Well, I think there's truth to that. There was during the time when Rolly was the coach there, the Big East as a conference became huge. And it became one of the first, what they call now, power conferences. And that Villanova was part of that. And in Raleigh's scheme of things, being a guy that's not was not from here, he was not bred in the Philadelphia cradle of coaches. You know, Raleigh viewed the Big East as more important than the Big Five, which was heresy to people in Philadelphia basketball, that anything could be bigger than the Big Five. But he was playing the long game. He was looking at the big picture. And winning the Big East became their goal. And the idea of the Big Five games almost became kind of a nuisance to Raleigh, that he had to deal with these four city series games, which were big games to the teams. But in Raleigh's scheme of things, no, that Syracuse is a big game. Georgetown is a big game. Your game with LaSalle is not that big. And that really, really rankled longtime Philadelphia basketball fans. And you know, Villanova kind of strong-armed the Big Five into splintering and getting away from the true round robin, and they began this sort of bastardized sort of couple games a year, and it wasn't any of the Big Five anymore. Now, they've since pieced it back together, and the Big Five now kind of exists as it existed back in the day, other than the fact that they no longer play every game at the Palestra, which I wish they would, but they now play in the campus sites. But at least now you've got a true round robin, and a true city champion has emerged. And I think that people have kind of forgiven that era of Raleigh. I think people enough time has passed now that I think people, I mean, they were angry for a while. I think they're kind of past that now. And I think Raleigh's legacy is pretty secure. But I think what Mike was saying is that was there some hard feeling and was there some polarization in the wake of that? Yeah, there absolutely was.
One more question, Ray. What was Raleigh to his players?
They called him Daddy Mass. I mean, that was what he was called, and he was viewed as a true father figure. And I think that one of the things that Jay Wright has done successfully at Villanova now is continue that. I mean, they talk about the Villanova family, the Villanova basketball family is something they talk about out there. And it's a very real thing to those guys. And it didn't just start with Jay. I mean, Jay is a disciple of Raleigh, and that all started with Raleigh. So that idea of being a family, being a unit, going over and having dinner at the coach's house and the wife cooking it, and, you know, the coach years later getting on the phone on Christmas Day and calling everybody at home and asking how they're doing. I mean, that kind of thing, which is kind of unique in Division I big-time college basketball. I know Jay continues to do it, but it really started with Raleigh.
Well, we do have Raleigh to thank, in large part at least, for that iconic Philadelphia moment back in 1985. Okay, on to the Eagles. Mike Sielski, how has preseason looked so far?
They emerged relatively healthy, Mary, and I think that's probably the most important thing. You know, there's a lot of debate among people who cover the NFL and even within the NFL about how much work, so to speak, the best players on any team should get during the preseason. You're always balancing the reward of, you know, players sharpening their skills and getting ready for the season with the risk of them getting injured. And the Eagles emerged relatively unscathed. Carson Wentz is fine. Most of their key players on offense and defense are fine. I think people might be a little concerned that Coach Doug Peterson played his starters as little as he did throughout the preseason. But I think in the grand scheme of things, if you're an Eagles fan, you have to feel pretty good because you have your entire complement of important players on offense and defense.
In the time Wentz has been on the field, Mike, this preseason, what have you seen of him? I mean, how would you characterize his performance?
Generally, I think he's looked pretty sharp. I thought he looked very good, actually, in their most recent game against the Miami Dolphins last week. He made some really good throws in some tight windows, including some throws down the field. He looks very confident. He looks like he's moving pretty well in the pocket. He did try to make a tackle on one play, an interception. He had a ball batted into the air, and a Dolphins lineman intercepted it. And Wentz got in there and tried to make the tackle on the guy. I think the entire Eagles organization, from owner Jeffrey Lurie on down, held their breath when they saw that. But he turned out to be fine. So I like what I've seen of Wentz so far.
Right. What do you think?
I think he's been very good. I would take this all the way back through spring camps, OTAs, training camp, practice, all that stuff. I mean, he's looked very good. I mean, he's a guy that has, he knows now this is his team. I mean, it was about this time last year that they made the Sam Bradford trade, and all of a sudden Carson Wentz is anointed as the starter.
Who is he?
And
yeah.
he was just kind of thrust into yeah. it. Well, now he's had a whole year. He's had 16 regular season games of experience. He's had a whole offseason to recognize the fact that he's now the leader of the team. And he seems entirely comfortable in that role, which is a big part of it. They struggled in the Buffalo game, which was the second of the two preseason games. But I thought he played well against Miami. I would have liked to have seen him play more. I would have liked to have seen him get at least a whole half in. That, to me, is if I have any concerns about Wentz right now, it's not about him as much. I think he's a really good player. But my only concern is, has he played enough with the new players he's with right now to be ready when the season starts next Sunday? Because the Eagles' early season schedule is difficult. First two games on the road, home opener against a good Giants team. They're starting out in a tough spot, and I just don't know if that first unit offense with two new receivers and a new running back has had enough time to work together to be really at peak efficiency when they go down to Washington. But as far as Wentz as a player, I think Wentz is going to be fine.
Well, let's get into talking about who might back him up, heaven forfend, should he be injured. Nick Foles, the primary backup, has been suffering from what's been called elbow soreness for the longest time. What's going on here? Is it clear, Mike?
It's not really clear. The Eagles have said all the right things generally about Foles' status, that they have confidence in him to master the system, and that he'll be fine, that he doesn't really need to play in the preseason, apparently. But the fact remains that your backup quarterback has not taken a snap in any preseason game. There have been times where he has practiced a couple days in a row and then not practiced or played after that. So it is a concern for this reason. They spent a lot of money to sign Foles in the offseason to bring him in to solidify the backup position behind Wentz. And if he is not able to play, if they keep him on the roster, but he's really not healthy enough to get in there and maybe help them win a game in a pinch if Wentz gets hurt, or, you know, God forbid, something longer than that, then they're going to have to use an extra roster spot on a third quarterback.
So McGloin is out. We're probably pretty much in agreement that McGloin will likely be out. Matt McGloin, the third quarterback.
In all likelihood, he's going to be cut. Yes.
So should the Eagles be looking for a third quarterback?
It's something they have to think about, and only they know, and only Nick Foles knows how healthy he really is. I don't think anybody really knows that at this point. I think it's something that they have to consider and they have to look at, even if they don't want to, because if you keep a third quarterback on your roster, you're hampering your depth at another position that might need an extra player.
Hmm. All right. You know, we're going to bring up one of your columns from Sunday, this past Sunday, Mike, after the break here, one in which you suggest that perhaps it's time that the Eagles consider Colin Kaepernick. So keep that thought in mind. Stay with us here on Radio Times. We're talking about the Eagles and then the Phillies and the Flyers and the Sixers and the Union, much more as we continue. It's our sports show today. And if you'd like to join the conversation, by the way, 888-477-9499 is the number. Send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Mike Sielski, Ray Didinger are with us for the hour. And keep it here. There's more ahead. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings. Jordan Marty's got the day off today. And today we're talking about tonight's game, the last preseason game in which for the Eagles, in which they play the Jets at the Meadowlands. And we're taking a look ahead to the 2017 regular season. And joining us in studio, Ray Didinger, who is an analyst, football analyst with CSN Philly. Mike Sielski is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And going into the break, we were talking about whether the Eagles should consider having a third quarterback on the roster. Should they let Matt McGloin go on Saturday? And Mike, I'll kind of paraphrase your column Sunday a little bit. You write, this is not a hot take. This is not an attempt to generate internet clicks. And then you go on to say the Eagles are approaching the point they should start considering whether it's worth signing Colin Kaepernick. Tell us about that.
Well, getting back to what we had discussed before the break, I was looking at their situation with respect to their backups, with respect to Nick Foles and his arm injury. And as I said in the column, if the Eagles are completely confident that Nick Foles is going to be able to step in and play for Carson Wentz if necessary, then fine, they don't have a problem. If Carson Wentz plays 99.47% of all the snaps this season, just like he did last season, that's fine. But if those things don't happen, and given the way things have played out in training camp in the preseason, it's reasonable to think they may not happen. The Eagles are going to have to think about bringing in another quarterback. And at this point in the preseason, with the regular season now less than 2 weeks away, your options are relatively limited. And the big option out there would be Colin Kaepernick. Now, there are a whole bunch of reasons, understandable reasons, why you wouldn't do that if you're the Eagles. But there are enough reasons that you might think about it that I think it would be irresponsible of the Eagles to just to say we can't consider it at all.
Let me bring in a comment from Dave, because this works right in with the conversation. Dave says, please ask the guests about how they feel about Colin Kaepernick being blackballed by the NFL due to his political views. Mike, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think his political views are certainly part of the reason that teams have not been willing to sign him so far. I don't think it's the entirety of it. And any honest discussion of Kaepernick and why he's not in the NFL right now has to take a couple things into consideration. One, he was a pretty unique quarterback as it was. He thrived in a certain kind of system when he was a starter. And while he was a starter in San Francisco, his play regressed pretty substantially from the 2013 Super Bowl, when he came within a play of winning the 49ers a championship, and the season since then. So is it partly about his political views? Yes, probably it is. Is that the entirety of it? No, it's not.
He kneels during the national anthem. He did kneel during the national anthem because of he's protesting police brutality against African Americans. Ray Didinger, what do you think about, first of all, the necessity of having a third quarterback on the team, and secondly, Colin Kaepernick?
Well, you need to have a third guy somewhere, whether he's active on Sunday or not. You need to have a third guy to run your scout team stuff during the week and just lighten the load on your other two quarterbacks, so that there'll be a third guy around. The question is, would it be Kaepernick? What Mike's saying is, I mean, there's some truth to that. If Nick Foles, if we're to take Doug Peterson at his word and Nick Foles is actually going to be okay to be your backup quarterback, then fine. Then you don't really have an issue. But if there really is a physical problem here and there's some doubt about his ability to perform if he's asked to perform, then you have to reconsider other options. You know, McGloin, the only thing McGloin's got going for him is the fact that he's been here throughout the whole training camp and he knows the offense. So if something happens and he has to grab a helmet and go on the field, at least he knows where people are going to line up and what plays to call. But, I mean, he's not a very good player. And if you had to actually go with him, I doubt that you could win a game, to be perfectly honest. As far as Kaepernick goes, the term blackball is being thrown around a lot, and I've heard the term collusion brought up, that the owners have colluded to keep him out. I don't think there's collusion in the sense that 32 owners have sat in a room and decided this. I think 32 guys have decided independently that they don't want the bother. They don't want the blowback. They don't want the controversy. If what they're going to bring in, nobody's going to bring him in right now as a starter. They would be bringing him in as a backup. And teams are making an organizational decision that, look, if we're bringing him in as a backup, we don't need the baggage he's going to be bringing with him. We don't need the controversy. We don't need the picketers. We don't need Spike Lee. We don't need the TV networks coming here. The backup quarterback in an NFL situation ideally should be seen and not heard. So you don't want a backup quarterback that's going to create controversy just by being there. And that's what's really working against him. Now,
would he even consider being number two?
Well, oh, sure. He don't have a choice at this point. But the idea that he hasn't had a chance to compete for a spot on an NFL roster this year, I mean, it's just wrong. I mean, you look around the NFL right now. I mean, you got 32 teams. Each one of them has no less than three, in some cases, four quarterbacks on the roster right now. So you're talking about 120 quarterbacks that have been out there taking snaps this summer. No one, even what Mike said, is the kid regressing since his Super Bowl year? Sure, he has. But there's no way you can convince me he's not one of the 125 best quarterbacks out there available. So people are making a decision that's largely more about political reasons than football.
Well, along the lines of political activism, there was a picture of Malcolm Jenkins, who'd raised his fist during the national anthem in protest over racial injustice. I think that was in the Bills game against the Bills. Chris Long photographed putting his arm around Jenkins. You know, so this is still coming out in the field. How is the NFL handling this overall? And again, you know, you have this sort of action and then Kaepernick still sitting on the sideline. Mike?
I'm not sure what they can do to handle it.
They even be handling it? I mean, how are they approaching it? That might be a better way to put it.
I'm not sure they're approaching it any way at all. I think there's been no indication I think Roger Goodell, the commissioner, has spoken out, spoken about this once and kind of hinted that it would be nice if players stood for the anthem. Ray can correct me if I'm wrong about that. But, you know, I think for the most part, there would be, as much backlash as there might be to a team signing Kaepernick from people who don't like the fact that he is protesting during the anthem, I think the NFL and, you know, its executives probably fear the backlash if they were to become too heavy-handed about telling players that they have to stand for the anthem or trying to do that, something along those lines. I mean, this is something that's kind of it seems to have sprouted organically. You know, Kaepernick really kind of got the ball rolling on this, and I'm not quite sure what the league could say or even should say in this regard.
Well, I guess the question is, if more players are doing their own form of protest on the field, then is Kaepernick still as much of a lightning rod as he was, Ray?
Yeah, because it started with him.
Okay.
And what you've seen is you've seen a lot of it in this preseason, especially in the wake of Charlottesville. Last weekend, the Cleveland Browns had 12 players. 12 of their players make some form of demonstration, either kneeling or raising a fist or sitting down on the bench. That's a lot. I mean, that's a lot. This has become a very hot topic. And there are a lot of people, if you read op-ed pieces, you read letters to the editor, there are a lot of people that are really offended by this. And there are a lot of hardcore, football fans who have just said, I don't want this. I don't want to deal with this. I'm tired of it. I watch football on Sundays. I'm trying to escape this other stuff to watch football. I don't want to be confronted with this. And there are a lot of people in Cleveland, and I heard a lot of people in Cleveland on the talk radio stations out there calling up and saying, I'm done with it. I'm done with football. Mm-hmm. If that's the way this is going to be, because the Browns have been bad anyway. The people don't need any other reason to be alienated from the Browns other than their one loss record. But this on top of it, I mean, you've had a significant pushback by the Browns fans saying, I'm just done with this. And at a certain point, the people on Park Avenue in Roger Goodell's office, they have to start listening to this. Now, I think what Mike said is true. I don't know what they can do. I don't know how the league comes forward and forbids players from expressing their individual constitutional right. I just don't know how you do that. I certainly wouldn't. I think if these guys want to do it, I think they can do it. But they have to understand that there's going to be criticism and there's going to be controversy that goes along with it. And maybe in the extreme case, you wind up like Colin Kaepernick where you don't even have a job.
Yeah. Any final thoughts, Mike, before we move on to John Dornbus?
No, I think, Ray touched on something that I think is very interesting and kind of salient, which is, the way we view sports and particularly the NFL in our society nowadays, it seems politics is with us all the time. It can be difficult to escape it, whether it's through social media, 24-hour news, the focus on the president, all that kind of stuff. And, it gets to a question of whether there are certain entities or days or things in our society where we can kind of escape and, put our minds away from those sorts of things. And I think that issue gets to the heart of all this, is that there's a lot of people who just say to themselves, I just want to be able to watch the Eagles or the Browns or the Patriots for 3.5 hours on a Sunday and not have to worry about all this stuff, which is infiltrating my life the other 6 days of the week. So I think that's a big issue and part of this whole thing.
Well, I promised we'd move on to John Dornbus, but I do want to get this comment in from Sherry because she makes an interesting point. So they won't bring on Kaepernick because of blowback from racists, but Mike Vick was fine. Kaepernick and every American has a right to express their First Amendment rights. You know, you point out, Mike, in one of your articles that, you know, the backstories are incomparable. You know, Kaepernick is an activist exercising his First Amendment rights, and Vick was convicted for his role in a dogfighting ring, and the Eagles took him.
Yeah, and what is comparable, though, Mary, I would suggest, is the blowback, the reaction, you know, what Ray mentioned earlier, and franchises being willing to accept that. And the reason I pointed that out with respect to Vic and Kaepernick was that the Eagles in 2009 were willing to accept that blowback of signing a player who had spent 18 months in prison for dogfighting. And eventually it all dissipated because eventually Mike Vick started helping the Eagles win football games, and the whole thing kind of went away. So take that for what it's worth.
All right. We're talking to Mike Sielski, Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist, Ray Dittinger as well. He is a football analyst for CSN Philly. And right now we're on the Eagles. We'll get to the other sports team, sports teams as well in just a few moments. But so long snapper John Dornbos. The magic man, I guess he's called, is out. Ricky Lovato is in, and I think that's because of his stint on America's Got Talent. Am I correct, Ray Dittinger? How does special teams look?
Well, I think special teams will be fine. The punter, Donnie Jones, is one of the best in the league. The place kicker, Caleb Sturgis, is coming off a really good year. So I think in terms of the kickers, I think they're in pretty good shape. The big change is going to be, and they have Darren Sproles coming back to do most of the returning, and he's certainly done that for a long time. I don't think you have any worries there. The big change is the change at long snapper, and John Dornbos has been that for more than a decade. And I think over that period of time, he's been the best long snapper in football. But the Eagles made a decision this year where I think it's financially driven. They have a guy named Rick Lovato who is a specialist in the same way that Dornbos is a specialist. This is what he is. He's a long snapper. He's been around the league. He's been with Green Bay. He's been with the Bears. He's been with a couple teams. He's an itinerant special teams guy, as they tend to be. But the art of being able to long snap, which it is, it's an art. I mean, this guy can do it. And they feel like they're comfortable enough with him that they can let Dornbos go and save some money under the salary cap. But one of the things that that I wonder about this team now is two of the bigger moves that they've made in terms of moving on from veteran players this offseason were Jordan Matthews being traded and now trading John Dornbos to New Orleans. And they were two of, at least in my view, two of the most popular guys in the dressing room. I mean, they were guys that everybody on the team liked them. They were guys that in their own way, on their own units, were strong leaders. You do affect the team chemistry when you make a move like that. I mean, I understand that change and turnover and roster turnover is a part of pro football, and it's something they all have to learn to live with. And some guys leave, and there's not a ripple on the water. You know, a guy leaves, and everybody just says, well, that's football. But sometimes guys leave, and all of a sudden there's a void.
Yeah.
And you felt it when Jordan Matthews left. I mean,
25 years old.
Carson Wentz certainly felt it. I mean, he was his best friend on the team. I mean, he felt it, and they all felt it with John Dornbos.
Well, so how critical is something like that, the Wentz-Matthews professional relationship, to what happens on the field?
You can't say it doesn't exist. It does exist. But, again, it's a fact of life of pro football. You make a decision that's for the greater good of the roster, and they had to bring in a defensive back. They had to improve the secondary. And the way to improve the secondary was to make the trade for Darby, and to make the trade for Darby, they had to give up Jordan Matthews. And it was something no one liked. I mean, none of the players liked it. But I think they all, when they all took a good look at it, they said, you know what, yeah, we needed a cornerback, and it's a shame that Jordan had to be the price that we had to pay, but I think they recognized that was a move that they had to make. But they're going to miss these two guys. I mean, they really were positive influences on the team. And I know one of the things from an organizational standpoint, from the Eagles organizational standpoint, the Eagles like to be a team that's very proactive in the community. They like to go out and they like to go to schools and they like to build playgrounds and they like to do all this kind of stuff. And good for them. I mean, I think they do it a lot. But two of the guys that were absolutely the most active in that area were Jordan Matthews and John Dornbos. If they had an appearance or they had to go to somebody, had to go to speak at a school or something, the first two guys to put their hands up were Matthews and Dornbos. Yeah. Well, somebody else is going to have to fill that void now.
Well, Mike Sielski, do you see anybody else filling those cleats?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think, you know, Carson Wentz, they would like him to be that guy, but he's almost in – the quarterback is almost such an exalted position that – You know, do you want him being the guy who's, as Ray said, is going out and speaking to the school children, you know, all the time, you know, maybe once in a great while. You know, within that locker room now, you're looking around for leaders. There's a guy like Brent Celek, who's now the longest tenured player on the team. He's been on the team, I guess, 10 years now, if not more. You know, what's interesting to me about the Dorenbos situation, to bring it back to Kaepernick for a second, is that I do it's almost a uniquely Philadelphian thing that the fans of the Eagles would grow so attached to the team's long snapper. And part of it is because, you know, he had gone in America's most, you know, America's Got Talent. He had an incredible backstory.
He used to do magic tricks in the locker room, I read.
Magic tricks in the locker room, that sort of thing. And it speaks to how sports fans want to connect with the athletes, you know, and the whole question of, do we want these guys to be good people? Do we want them to represent our values, however we might define them? Or do we just want mercenaries who are going to put on the jersey of our favorite team and help us win games? And I think Kaepernick and Dorenbos, for a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, kind of represent the two sides of that equation. You know, I got a lot of emails from a lot of Eagles fans after I wrote that Kaepernick column saying, I will never root for the Eagles again if they sign Colin Kaepernick.
You probably got that, though, when Michael Vick was signed.
Exactly. And, you know, the flip side is now you have people upset that John Dorenbos is no longer on the Eagles because he was such a good guy. Never mind the fact that they probably paid no attention to what he was doing during the game, you know, snapping the football on, you know, punts and field goals and extra points.
All right. So one more short moment on Colin Kaepernick. If he were to be brought to Philadelphia, do you think that he would eventually be embraced by the fans, especially if he were to perform on the field, Mike?
In this total hypothetical situation, I think, because I don't think it's going to happen. I think if he were to help the Eagles, if he were in a situation where he were playing quarterback for them and helping them win games in the way that Michael Vick did, they would embrace him eventually. Most people would embrace him eventually. I think the circumstances were to change if he were to be a backup and he were to continue to be outspoken. There would probably be a sizable portion of the population and the fan base who would resent that and dislike it. You know, Vic, when he was here initially as a backup, just kind of went about his business, you know, and did what he needed to do. So I think Kaepernick would have to do something similar if that were ever the situation.
All right, we're spending a few more moments on the Eagles, and we're on to the Phillies for our, well, semi-annual sports show here on Radio Times. Mike Sielski is with us, Ray Didinger as well, and we hope you stay with us for the rest of the hour. Number to call if you'd like to jump in, 888-477-9499. This is WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, along with Ray Didinger, football analyst for CSN Philly, and Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And we've been talking about the Philadelphia Eagles, and they play the New York Jets tonight in their final game of the preseason. So, Mike, what are you expecting tonight against the Jets?
A lot of players whom casual observers and followers of the Eagles will not recognize and probably won't see play for them again. The fourth preseason game is, you know, it's helpful to the coaches because they're making final judgments and decisions about who to keep on the roster. But in terms of the quality of play, and Ray knows this better than anybody, he's watched a lot of fourth preseason football games in his life. You know, it can be a hard, hard watch.
So time for, you have any thoughts there, Ray?
Oh, that's, you know, there's very little to add to that. It is. It's tough to watch because none of the real players, none of the players who are going to be starting
September
in 10th. a week from now are going to play tonight. I mean, they won't even see the field. So in fact, a lot of them may not even dress. They'll just be on the sideline in sweats and baseball caps. And so this is a game for the guys on the third on the depth chart, fourth on the depth chart. You know, some guys will be fighting for a spot tonight. I mean, a couple guys might win a job tonight. A couple guys might lose a job tonight. But in terms of being watchable football, no, it won't. And, you know, Mike's right. I mean, I've been watching this a long time. I've been watching this so long. I was covering the Eagles back when they played six preseason games. I mean, people are complaining now about four preseason games being too many. Remember back in the day when they actually played six of these? I mean, that was really, really tough to see.
Probably came away with a lot of injuries.
Yeah, well, and rosters were bigger. I mean, yeah. You know, they would bring back in those days, they would bring 100, 120 guys to training camp and weed them out over the course. And sometimes they needed six games to get through that many players. But now they've got it streamlined a bit, but it still makes that fourth preseason game. It doesn't make it any more watchable.
So the first game is in D.C., in Washington, September 10th. What are you expecting there? Tough team, right?
I think it's a tough game for the Eagles.
Yeah.
I really do, because Washington has been poison for them for the last few years. They have real trouble with the Redskins. And I don't think the Redskins are going to be a particularly good team over the course of the whole season. But I think catching them at home the first week is not a good spot. Like if they were going to be playing the Redskins like after Thanksgiving down in Washington, I would feel differently about the game. But getting them week one down there, given your recent history against the Redskins, I think that's a tough opener for the Eagles. I really do. And then the next week, they have to go on the road yet again and play a good Kansas City team in Kansas City, where the Chiefs rarely lose. So, I mean, I look at those first two games as being very, very tough games for the Eagles, and it kind of gets back to what I was saying at the beginning of the show, is I just wonder how ready this offense is, how ready Wentz is, how comfortable he is with his new players around him. You know, are they ready to really come out of the blocks fast week one of the season? Because they're going to have to, because those first two games, especially on the road, are going to be very, very testy.
Mike, what do you think?
No, I agree with Ray. I think the opener against the Redskins is a real telltale game for the Eagles this season. As Ray mentioned, FedEx Field has been a house of horrors for them in recent years. And I'll take the flip side of his concern, though. In recent years, the Eagles have really had a problem stopping the Washington offense, getting them off the field. That was a big issue last year in the game they played in Landover, Maryland. The Redskins won the game 27-20, but the game was not nearly that close. The Redskins really dominated the game. And a big issue that day was that the Redskins could run the ball whenever they wanted to and were able to extend drives. So I think that's going to be, as I said, kind of a telltale game. If the Eagles are able to win that game, boy, that's a big boost to them as they begin the season.
And Mike, just a little sidebar here. The controversy over the Washington team name, is that on the back burner for now?
I think by all indications it is. You know, it doesn't seem to be as hot button a topic, you know, now as it was maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago. You know, I've seen some polling that indicates that you know, there isn't a whole lot of public support behind the idea of changing the franchise's name. So it does seem to be kind of a back burner issue at the moment.
It hasn't totally gone away, though. I read a story this week that the principal at a high school in suburban Washington, actually Bethesda, which is a suburb of Washington, the principal has sent out a notification to all the kids coming back to school this year that they will not be allowed to wear any redskin garb to school. And
really?
You know how much kids, high school kids,
sure,
wear team apparel to schools these days. It's huge. He won't allow them to wear any redskin stuff because he regards it as a slur.
I'll have to follow that story. See how that shakes out. All right, on to the Sixers. Elton Brand, who is now general manager of a team called the Delaware 87ers, which is a G League affiliate, said recently of the Sixers, "The hype is justified." And Mike Sielski, fans have been snapping up season tickets. The last figure I saw was 14,000 or so.
Yeah, the franchise apparently has set an off-season record for season ticket sales, you know, well north of 14,000. So there is some genuine excitement about what the Sixers can be this year. I think the bigger question is what exactly they're going to be. This is still a very, very young team. It does have a lot of talent on it, but that talent is not really in any way NBA refined. What you see throughout the league and have seen for a long time is that teams that are older, that are veteran-laden, are teams that thrive in the NBA. Now, they have great players, but those players have been around for a little while. The Sixers do not have players. Their core players are not that. Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons, Markel Fultz, these are all guys who are 22, 21, 20. So while there's a lot of talent there and expectations are higher, I think the idea that the Sixers are going to challenge for a championship this season might be a bit far-fetched.
Well, the league seems to be optimistic. They get 14 nationally televised games this season, including Christmas, and it's been a long time since they've played on Christmas Day. I think they're against the Knicks this year. What does this tell us about, if anything, about what the league is thinking, right?
Well, I think across the league, yeah, there is a lot of, I don't know if you could call it interest or curiosity about this team. It's probably a little bit of both, because everybody knows what the Sixers have been through over the last few years. The whole Sam Hinkie experiment, the process, quote unquote, in terms of acquiring the players, acquiring the picks that allowed them to build the players, basically throwing away several seasons to acquire players to build a team that they felt could not just be okay, but build a team that could be a championship team. Well, now you're kind of at the fruition of that. Now you're kind of at the end of that, and now they've got these players. And I think there's a lot of curiosity, tremendous curiosity in Philadelphia, as you point out, in terms of the ticket sales. And I think everybody's looking forward to the TV ratings spiking big time this year because there's just a lot of interest here. But there's a lot of interest all across the league, and that's reflected in the TV and in their national TV exposure. They haven't gotten this kind of national TV exposure in years and years. I mean, certainly since Iverson was here. So that's true enough. But I think Mike's right in that. I mean, it'd be unrealistic to think that they're going to contend for a championship this year. But I do think you can think about them competing for a playoff spot. And
they might be exciting.
And, yeah, and I think, honestly, if you ask me right now, I think they will make the playoffs. I really do. The East isn't that strong or that deep. So they got a lot of talented kids that they have to learn to play together. But I think at the end of the year, I'd be surprised if they weren't a playoff team.
What do you think, Mike?
I agree with that. I believe Las Vegas set the over-under for their victories this season at around 42. I'm probably a little more optimistic about that. I think they could probably win about 45 games. And I think Ray is right. I think they should be a playoff team with the way the Eastern Conference is shaping up. A few teams have taken steps backward. The teams that were already at the top of the conference, Cleveland and Boston, just recently completed a big trade, and one could argue they're still the two teams at the top of the conference. Maybe they flip-flop. Maybe the Celtics are the number one, you know, seed, so to speak, at this point. But I do think the Sixers can make some hay. As young as they are, they're pretty talented.
All right, to the Phillies. Phillies rookie Rhys Hoskins, a phenom who seems to have come out of nowhere, 11 home runs in his first 18 major league games. Where did he spring from, Mike?
Well, he's really had kind of a steady rise throughout their minor league system. He's hit for power, hit for average at virtually every rung of their system as he's come up. So, yes, it's a surprise that he has hit this well. I mean, he's been basically the best and most productive hitter in baseball over the last, you know, 3 weeks or so. But I don't think it's too surprising that he is playing and hitting reasonably well because he has hit reasonably well at every level, you know, throughout the Philly system. So, you know, he is definitely a reason to get excited. He's got a very mature approach at home plate. He understands the strike zone, is a very disciplined hitter, and wow, the ball just jumps off his bat.
The Inquirer's Marcus Hayes compares Hoskins to a young Chase Utley. Hoskins writes, simply reeks of Utley, only bigger, stronger, and more personable. High praise indeed, Ray.
Yeah, I don't know that I would. To me, they're very different players. I mean, it's one guy's a pure power hitter, and the other guy was a middle infielder. So, but in terms of popularity, in terms of generating excitement, yeah. I mean,
Hayes goes on to say, not since Utley arrived in Philly in 2003 has a rookie shown this combination of talent, maturity, and polish. Maybe that's where he's going.
Yeah, so he's not really comparing them as players as much as he is public figures, I suppose. I think that it's funny to hear people talk about this. It's almost like people are talking about him like he's Roy Hobbs or Shoeless Joe or something.
We just really need someone here in Philadelphia spark some excitement.
Yeah, I mean, like the fact that he just kind of just stepped off a truck and all of a sudden here he went. No, he actually, Mike's right. I mean, he's been, if anybody's been tracking him through the minor leagues, knew that this kid had a lot of promise and a lot of power. And in fact, just this week, he was named the most valuable player in the league that he played in, the International League, before he came up here. So he had that good of a season. So everything about him, if you look through his credentials, they've all been indicating that he was going to be a really good power hitter. But I think the fact that he has been able to accomplish what he accomplished in the number of games that he played is extraordinary. And no one in the history of baseball, in the entire history of baseball, had as many home runs as he had in his first 18 games. So what we've been witnessing is something pretty unprecedented.
So as much fun as he is to watch, the rebuilding continues.
Well, especially
on
the pitcher's mound.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, we've got Aaron Nola and...
And nothing.
So, we don't have a whole lot of time left in the show, but any arms out there that the Phillies might be considering, Mike?
Well, they're probably going to sign at least one, if not more than one, veteran pitcher in the offseason. But I think they're going to maintain kind of the pose and strategy that they've maintained so far, which is they're going to sign veteran pitchers to relatively short-term contracts and hope they can, catch lightning in a bottle or something like that. The irony of their poor pitching is that they really hoarded a lot of young pitchers over the last couple of years, hoping that kind of the cream would rise to the top. And really nothing has risen anywhere except, as Ray said, Aaron Nola. Yeah. So they're going to have to do some deep digging, I think, to fix this, because it's a major problem. Their pitching's been terrible.
When do we get a season that's past over 500?
Well, if they can shore up the pitching, I don't think they're that hopeless. I mean, you're looking at a team that has a really good chance of losing 100 games, and that's pretty awful. But when you look at the lineup, you look at the eight players, they're not that far away. If Hoskins is anything close to what we think he can be, I think the outfield, they've got a pretty good outfield. The middle of the infield with Hernandez and Galvez is fine. The third baseman, Franco, is killing them. I mean, they thought he was going to be a good player, and he's been 2 years now a disappointment. But I think in terms of the eight daily players, they're not that far away. But the pitching staff is complete ruin. I mean, they have Aaron Nola, and they have nothing else.
Yeah. All right, let's quickly touch on the Flyers and the Union Flyers. First, they are retiring number 88 on January 19th, Mike. Eric Lindros?
Yeah, absolutely deserving. Lindros got into the Hall of Fame this year, and while his career with the Flyers was definitely star-crossed for, a multitude of reasons, concussions, controversy related to his relationship with Bob Clark, the former team president and general manager, if you go back and look at his numbers and if you saw him play in his early seasons with the team, there's no doubt that, he deserves to have his number retired. He was a great, great player when he was healthy and at his best.
And the Union, another tough season, eighth place in the Eastern Conference. Playoff hopes are pretty much non-existent. Coach Jim Curtin has been there, I guess, a few years, Ray. How patient are owners in general these days?
I don't know. In soccer, in some sports, they're not patient at all. In soccer, they seem to be maybe a little bit more. I think I don't pay a whole lot of attention to the Union, but what little bit I have, it seems like they've turned the roster over a couple of times. It doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of stability within the organization. I know they were awful at the beginning of the season, and then he turned them around, and they actually played fairly respectably. And up until a couple of weeks ago, they were still thinking about a playoff spot. So I don't think Curtin is the problem. I think the problems in the organization lie maybe above him. I would like to see him stay because I think he's a pretty good coach. I think he's a pretty sound coach. But I think they need to decide what they want to be as an organization first.
Okay, before we go to prognostication for the Eagles, just one more question, Ray. You about 30 seconds. Your experience as a playwright, Tommy and Me, has just finished its run, a one-act show about your friendship with Eagles legend Tommy McDonald. So how's it been to see this very unique part of your life brought to life on the stage every night?
It was incredibly exciting. I mean, this is the second time we brought it back. We had it last summer for 12 performances. This summer we did 17 performances at the Fringe Arts Theater. They all sold out. People came and they just loved it. It's a true story about my relationship with Tommy McDonald, starting out as a 10-year-old boy at Eagles training camp, carrying his helmet to the practice field. The little bit of a friendship we developed then, how he kind of took me under his wing. And then later on down the road when I became a sports writer, kind of leading the effort to get him into the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Is there more ahead? More writing? More theater?
Well, I don't know. I'm hopeful that the story can live on. And with the popularity and the success that it's had so far, I think it may yet have a future. I would like to think that.
Okay, so the prognostication. The Eagles, as I recall, you guys were pretty close to the eventual record of 7-9 for last year, the last time we did this show. Mm-hmm. What do you think for the 2017 campaign, Ray?
I'm saying 8-8. I think the team's moving in the right direction, but I think the schedule is going to be a real challenge.
All right, and Mike Sielski.
Great minds think alike, 8-8.
All right, we'll hold you to it. Mike Sielski, as always, it was a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mary.
Mike is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Ray Dittinger, great to have you with us as well.
Always a pleasure, Mary. Thank you.
Ray does football analysis for CSN Philly. And this reminder, when you get the chance, check out our Facebook page and our podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for joining us for Radio Times.